This is an amateur recording of Seamus Young's book, How I Learned. It can be found online at his website, seamusyoung.com/20sided tale.
Chapter 6, Flower Child. It's 1979, and I'm in second grade. School is much the same as last year, so let's talk about home life instead. Mom has to get up early, take us to the babysitter, then drive an hour to work. After work, she drives an hour to get to home, picks us up, and cooks dinner while we watch Mr. Rogers' Sesame Street or The Electric Company on our 14-inch black-and-white television. She might save time if we had a microwave, but who can afford such exotic, cutting-edge things like that? Microwaves are for rich people. Besides, some people say they might accidentally bombard your face with radiation and melt your skin or give you cancer or something. Once dinner is over, there are perhaps 2 hours before it's time to begin the long, complicated process of getting Patrick and I to bed, which itself is simply the preamble to the even more challenging task of getting Pat and I to go to sleep. Mom cherishes the hours after we go to sleep, and usually spends them reading in the living room. She's a big Tolkien fan. She sits on one side of the living room, near the window. The houses here are so close that an adult could probably lean out the window and touch the side of the neighbor's house. If Patrick and I sneak out of bed and turn on the light, it will shine on the neighbor's house, and she will see it right away. It will take us years to figure out how she knows when we turn the light on.
Let's see, where were we? Figure out how she knows when we turn the lights on. Bedtime was such a complex ritual that sometimes required several teams of childhood sleep technicians working round the clock to get Pat and I into a state of mind where we might agree to lay down and close our eyes. Here is Grandma working a shift. Mom's a lab technician for Pittsburgh Paint and Glass. She spends her day testing paint in various ways. The job often looks something like this. Paint some bits of aluminum with 10 different paint mixtures, stick it into an oven for a couple of hours, then take it out and quantify the behavior of the paint, or maybe test the paint for viscosity, or drying speed. It turns out that there are a lot of properties to paint. How smooth it is, how thick it is, how strong the odor is, how long it takes to dry, how it behaves when drying at different levels of humidity, how glossy it is, how long it lasts, how strong it is, how watertight it is, how long it holds color, how evenly it blends, how it bonds with various surfaces, including other paint, and how expensive the components are. The chemist can fiddle with these with her slide rulers and £1,500 calculators to come up with new formulations, but it comes to fine-tuning the mix and deciding if the customers will benefit from more X or more Y. There really is no substitute for handing the stuff to an army of testers and seeing how the paints perform. This is technical work, and so most of the other staff is comprised of men. Mom is nicknamed Wheels because she wears a dress. See, the guys ask what she has under the dress, and then conclude that she has wheels under there. Looking back, I strongly suspect they were hoping for evidence to the contrary. They decorate their shared lab space with cheesecake. Mom decides to hang up a picture of a handsome man to even things out. By the end of the day, someone has taped a piece of paper over a part of her man. It covers up his arm. And a crude replacement has been drawn, with the guy dangling a limp wrist. There's also a word bubble, now proclaiming, "I'm gay." Mom maintains a very positive attitude through all this. She complains a bit now and again, but she's not angry or bitter. These guys annoy her, but she does her job and pays the bills. We live next door to Mr. Love and his wife, a gentle, gray-haired couple of retirees. We don't see Mrs. Love very often, but Mr. Love is constantly working on his yard. The thing is an amazing accomplishment. It's a perfect blanket of brilliant, meticulously trimmed green, framed with rows of colorful flowers. This is even more impressive given the fact that the yards on either side of his house are made entirely of weeds, dirt, and toys pounded into the weeds and dirt. Every spring we raise a mighty crop of dandelions and then kick and puff the seeds into a great cloud. I have never seen a single dandelion grow in his yard. In the backyard, Mr. Love has an entire bank of tulips, and the top of this bank is the edge of our yard. Pat went and ripped the heads off a bunch of these tulips. He brought the resulting floral carnage to Mom as a bouquet, leaving a row of headless tulips on Mr. Love's hill. She explained to him that, 1, it was a very kind and touching gesture of love, and 2, he should not vandalize the neighbor's yard again. This exchange makes me curious about the plants. Why do they grow in his yard and not ours? Could we grow tulips of our own? How does this work? I'm digging around in the dirt one day when I decide to investigate this mystery. I yank up one of his tulips and notice that the bulb at the bottom of the plant. How interesting. I've seen something like this before, haven't I? Yes. I toss the uprooted flower on the ground and run inside. I open the fridge and take out one of these bulbs, an onion, and run back outside to plant it. There are steps on the back porch, but those face the driveway and nobody ever goes that way, so we jump off the 2-foot drop into the backyard. There's a large patch of dirt where even the weeds don't dare grow due to the never-ending onslaught of children disembarking from the porch. This is a nice open spot, so I decide to bury my tulip onion there. Then I run off and forget about it. Surprisingly enough, planting an onion into the endlessly pounded dirt does not cause a tulip to spring up. Much later, I confessed to Mom that I had planted some of our food in the yard. She's a good sport about it.